elevator pitch of this thing. It begins with a kind of weird fact that we found through researching the city government, and that is that the city of Carbondale has double the number of police of almost any other town this size in the country, and spends double on police. And we also noted that, and this is due to a lot of really specific issues in Illinois around its pension program, that the police pensions, the public safety pensions, are on track to kind of bankrupt the city. And there's a lot of different reasons for how that happened, but that's the kind of essential fact that the Carbondale Spring starts from. That as our population has dropped, we've got a situation where we are double policed compared to almost any other city in the country. And we're saying that's a blessing in disguise, because that means that the city has about $4 million that could be spent on much better things. And do you want to talk about, or we can just go on and talk about what those things that we've proposed are?
So we intend to right-size the Carbondale police budget and then are advocating for municipal funding of a team of care workers, right, community builders, people who go out into the community to solve complex crises that the police are currently being asked to solve that they may not necessarily need to be there for, right? Like, I'm sure we all have some idea in our minds of someone with a mental health crisis or like a mediation or like a dispute of some sort that would require mediation, not necessarily done by someone with a badge and a gun. That's what we're talking about as it relates to like this team of care workers.
Yeah, the other, the second positive proposal that we have is that we want, there's already a number of really wonderful community gardens through the city, but they always run up against this problem of volunteer labor. So they can't really scale into something that would be an alternate food system. And so just like the city currently pays an arborist to take care of the trees here, currently pays people to mow the lawns of the parks, we want the city to actually pay people to farm in the city. So municipal farm projects with the goal of creating a food social safety net within the town that would produce outside of the market as a kind of both as something that's contributing to people's everyday foods and as a kind of backup system for when the industrial agricultural system inevitably collapses or we collapse it.
So as I was becoming a more integrated community member, I transitioned into an entrepreneurial role that made me realize that the prosperity of this region has a much grander effect on everybody that is in business for themselves. So our worker cooperative model is directly addressing a crisis that is on a national level, the small business succession crisis, where we see this silver tsunami of baby boomers that are transitioning their businesses that they've worked so hard to build over decades, and the means that are available for people to take over those businesses are not available. So the most invested and most passionate citizens, they're not able to take over these things. It also, what it allows is to build ownership for the people that take over the cooperatives and allows the culture to change and allows for social capital to become something of a metric.
Describe the cooperative fund. We haven't said what the cooperatives are.
Yeah, I can do that probably. As Sonia was saying, there is a distinct inability due to wealth inequality for a conventional, like generational wealth transfer. So we find that the worker cooperative model might actually present the possibility of like mitigating the risk and lowering the barriers for people without a lot of money to go into business themselves. So we've taken a specific approach to this, and that's actually trying to build the worker cooperative ecosystem itself, not just specific worker co-ops. We looked at models throughout the world. One that we landed on, which has plenty of its own problems, is Mondragon from Basque Country, Spain. From there, we've taken a lot of lessons on how to incorporate it in this way, but also how to finance this. And we're very proud to put together the first revolving loan fund specifically regulated to worker-owned cooperatives that will be used in Carbondale, so it's very exciting. The second thing is a chamber of cooperation, which basically will be a technical assistance clearinghouse. You can think about eight people wanting to buy by their own business, they may be more adept at actually doing the work that produces the food that is served in that business, but may not quite understand bookkeeping, legal barriers, and that sort of thing. And we hope to centralize that inside of a federation that will provide those services.
Yeah. We also are in the process of proposing a group buy program of sorts and a renewable energy fund, something that like the municipality itself would be responsible for investing in renewable energy infrastructure here, moving away from the outdated fossil fuel industry. The group buy program that we're proposing would have higher income tiers subsidizing or just paying for lower income residents of the area to have their homes ran on solar or other renewable energy systems. And all of these projects that we're discussing, we're advocating for like municipal, long-term, sustainable municipal funding, right? So it's not like a grant program, it's not something that can be ripped away from us. We want these to be like an expansion of the way in which governing is done, right? Like they're approaching what their responsibilities are in a completely new way.
Yeah, that's a really important point. Thank you for saying that. That like basically one of the things that when we first started to think about these different initiatives, people that say, these are great ideas, you should apply for a grant for this thing. And one of the things we realized is that this is the way that political institutions avoid political questions, right? They don't have to actually wrestle with their responsibility around climate change or around folks who are suffering from mental disabilities and other things. They can just say, oh, it's a great idea, go ask a rich person for it, right? We're gonna fund the cops. And you know, like, and so the idea is to try to get this same ethic of the you know, where the cops aren't applying for a grant from the city every year in order to get it going, to say that this is the kind of responsibility that the city needs to take toward these more transformative endeavors. So we put this out there. Do you want to say something?
No, just like, would we like to? Could you finish your sentence?
We put this out there. And in the midst of a political campaign last year, and we kind of expected, okay, maybe it'll like mark a poll and people will take, you know, people that are running for office will pick and choose different ideas and will be watered down. But we were very surprised to find a bunch of people running for office actually say, yeah, let's do what those folks are saying.
Yeah.
And so it actually has a certain widespread like knowledge in the town. A lot of people know about it, a lot of people care about it. There's people within the city government that are like interested in helping us to kind of push this through, even though it's also a long-term pressure campaign too. Yeah.
Would we like to kind of run down the line and kind of speak toward what Carbondale Spring means to us subjectively? Because what we've talked about thus far is an objective, like this is what Carbondale Spring is on its face.
Yeah.
But like as we go through this process internally, there are like unique subjective reasons and interpretations for why each of us feel compelled to like act in this way or engage in this way.
I think I can actually segue
into
that. So what Nick's talking about is like severing local decision making from like the state, the feds, and like the corporate mechanisms that basically dominate those levels of government. And when you do that, it allows for like mass buy-in on these ideas in a very subjective way. I wanted to talk about that as well.
Yeah. For me, it's important to be engaged in something that, like, my contributions to this project are more through the aesthetic. I handle a lot of the social media. I was involved in the creation of the sort of branding around this and how we're like selling this to people. Giving them something that they can like identify with, right? And it's my intent, at least, as I contribute to this project, to pose political questions to the powers that be that redraw lines of conflict more accurately, right? Like in the current political dialogue, we are very often pitted against one another within this sort of like dog whistle terms. It's like you say something like the word socialist, or like the word small government, and you're like immediately relegated to these two sides of the political arena that are in opposition to one another. And what we've been doing throughout this process is intentionally creating language and like intentionally crafting a sort of accessible aesthetic, right? Something that anyone can see and superimpose themselves into with the intent to like kind of neutralize that divisive political rhetoric, but also allow for everyone to see in Carbondale the possibility of a future worth living in, like whatever that means to them. And that's very like important for me to like continue to maintain as I move forward with those projects.
For me, especially working with the worker cooperative, knowing that social capital and individual ownership leads to civic engagement and leads to more cooperation, more collaboration, and more communication within the community. Relying on each other and building those networks and relying on who knows who, who knows who, who knows who. So for me, it's building that social network and building something that's much deeper and much stronger than any political party can use against.
So I'm a police abolitionist. I come out of like the anarchist tradition, and that's usually what my like. I think often within that tradition, we kind of foreground a certain political analysis or something. And what I saw and what I hoped for in kind of like doing the groundwork for the Carbondale Spring was, you know, like, all right, you know, if I start talking to y'all about police abolitionists, maybe everybody in this room would agree with me after 15 minutes of talking about it. But we're totally powerless in terms of what we can do on that, or maybe we could do some kind of micro project here and there. But the question was, or what kind of like opened itself up through research on the actual police budget was like, hey, there's a way to actually concretely like reduce the number of police based on this totally different kind of argumentation that's actually like a strategic detournement of neoliberal argumentation. That I'm not making a political argument against the police, but I'm hinting at it, but in fact I'm making an economic argument against the police. That basically, over the last 40 years, literally everything has been on the table to be cut, except this massive blind spot in the policing and carceral apparatus, and you can wield that exact same logic against it, because of course that began through a kind of strategic, That began as an attack on the social movements of the 60s and 70s, particularly the Black Power movement. But everybody that's working within that logic has forgotten that. And so they actually are just like convinced by this notion that economics rules the day. And so then when you turn it back against the policing apparatus, they're like, shit, they've got a point there. And they scramble to figure out a reason for why it shouldn't work, you know? But so that for me was like a kind of essential motivation here. To kind of like innovate and put forward a practical strategy of police reduction within an abolitionist framework more broadly. That's really weird.
For me, first and foremost, this is a poor people's revolt. I think we can take a look at what's happened over the last two generations. They've taken everything, they destroyed everything in their wake. Lot of anger and rage out there because of that. We know that anger is a secondary emotion, right? And like every single one of us has this responsibility to peel back this onion and find out what's the primary source of that anger. But when you do that, you find anger, I mean, that's just righteous anger. And at that point, you should strategically find a way to point that shit in the right direction. So for me, that is what this is.
Would we like to kind of talk about Rojava and the Zapatistas as...
I would be happy to start that off. And,
yeah, it'd be wonderful.
So this is now like the third layer, the really weird layer of this, is that when the idea for the Carbondale Spring kind of began, it actually was immediately influenced by the ongoing revolution in northern Syria in the area called Rojava by the Kurds, which is currently being... destroyed by the Turkish state, and I just hope everybody understands that, you know, what's going on there is not just your standard ethnic conflict, and I put that in quotes, but in fact that there's a revolutionary process that has been undergone there since 2012, in which folks are trying to build a feminist, ecological, anti-state, anti-capitalist revolution, and fighting ISIS and all of that. And so it's particularly dreadful what's going on right now. But in fact, the very first draft of the Carbondale Spring was like based immediately on the organizational forms of the Kurds. And we were trying to think about, well, you know, like there's this amazing video that kind of breaks down how they're doing police abolition, how they're doing transformative justice, how they're doing, you know, what their education system's like. And we're like, let's just go around and show this video to everybody in their households. And the kind of problem that we hit upon, and this is based on like a lot of years of activist experience and problems, running into a lot of problems, is that in fact, like within the US, there's this like more ontological problem about like the loss of any sense of a common world. And so the strategy of the Carbondale Spring was basically we thought if we put forward these different political forms, all we're gonna do is invite political debate and political division, and the same people that usually talk about politics are gonna show up, and the same divisions are gonna happen. And so the question was like, maybe there's a way to frame it that is just intensely based on like immediate material problems and immediate material solutions that can try to like baby step us into the sense of a common world, out of which these political forms will then make more sense. And so the idea was like, rather than just being like, we're doing democratic confederalism like the Kurds are, to go a step back further and just be like, how, like in the midst of this like anxiety about disaster and stuff, how actually are we gonna feed ourselves? Like, have we thought about that together, you know?
The yeah. material conditions that we're dealing with here are very different than like what the Kurds are dealing with in the Middle East, right? Like, we live in the United States, and like we live in a country where capital has collectivized and fractured itself and our identities, and there are all sorts of like polarized political positions that one could take. And it's just very interesting. I'm happy to be involved in sort of, again, redrawing those lines of conflict here using like this baby step, right? Like, this is not a cure-all, but this is the first step toward getting people to understand like what the actual lines of conflict within our society here are, and like who our enemies are and who our friends are. Yeah, that's important for me, for sure.
So in the Western or the European Western context, these ideas have taken new form in something called municipalism. There's been an increase in power in places like Spain, Italy, Greece, but it's also coming stateside, actually the entire continent. What's interesting about this is it's all like based on these like hyper-local, unique platforms of need, where cities are redesigned politically around just need and space, not ideology. So that's really exciting.
Yeah. And so within our context, the question really was like, you know, at least for me, and what's, so for me, like I'm coming at this from like an anti-capitalist perspective where we need to get out of capitalism, but also there's this limit on our imagination about what that might even mean. And so the idea is to build the material conditions for extending the political imagination, right? That based on what you experience and see, that kind of limits or extends the scope of your imagination. And so in the broad sense, this is another project that the Carbondale Spring is kind of like a weird part of. It's called The Next Eclipse. And the aim is to take this time in between these two solar eclipses that are happening and intersect here in southern Illinois. The first one was 2017, the second one's 2024. But to use that time as a time to build the material conditions to extend the imagination in order to make something like regional autonomy thinkable by 2024.
So can I step in and then sort of start the questions?
Sure.
It's like so much to take in and so amazing. It's actually inspiring. So one thing I want to start with what you said is, one thing you mentioned, Claire, correct me if I get the term wrong, was an accessible aesthetic. Is that the term you used? And so given, but then you're also talking you think about the sort of material conditions, right, and extending the imagination. So I just wanted to hear more. I'm from Chicago, right, full disclosure, so I don't know. What's been the reception to your ideas, and what's been the feedback or pushback, even I imagine, maybe
repeat the question, please?
Yeah, I mean, what is the response then?
Okay, the response has been overwhelming, right? Like, I've never worked on a project, and I know Bo told me also that he's never worked on a project as well, where, like, we've gotten so many yeses and so very little no's, right? Now, there are individuals who would, like, maybe raise eyebrows or have questions or concerns about some of the stuff that we're putting forward. But the second you start asking them questions back about why they presuppose that things should be the way that they are and certain functions of government shouldn't be a certain way, it's like their logic tends to sort of fall apart. Or we can just, like, at least present a convincing case, right? Like, at the very least, we've built that up. And then I think that, like, the response has been humbling, gratifying, like deeply, deeply moving, touching. We've been in talks with inspiring people from all across the continent, right, about these ideas and sharing our ideas and collaborating with them. And like the fact that they feel energized by what we're doing and we can feel like on a reciprocal level energized about what they're doing. It's like we're kind of on the same wavelength. We're riding the same wave together. Like that has been just personally gratifying.
Interesting pushback, like specifically on the police thing, is like we're asking a lot of our friends. Like the most nervousness I've seen from that comes from like affluent white progressives that are being asked to like reimagine what their relationship is around like the armed section of the state. So a really good story about like care workers. Yesterday we were at the cooperative, right, a very progressive place. But a woman with a schizophrenia who's been banned from there was being arrested, right? But she just never remembered she's been banned from there. So like one of the reconfigurations we're asking for is potentially like a group of trained care workers would be the appropriate buffer between like interactions between each other and the police themselves.
So like a lot of this we've been able to, throughout talking with one another, talking to our community, doing this needs assessment, right, where we're like actually getting down to the root needs, the causes of a lot of really serious problems in our community, and like figuring out solutions to those problems, like just some solutions, so that like we can frame this in a way where it's just common sense, or like it makes common sense, or like is a common sense argument that we're proposing.
And I guess that's part of this idea of, I was really struck when you were talking about this sort of rhetorical aspect of this language, so just that phrase, needs assessment, I think is very compelling, right? Because I suppose that's really counter to the whole notion of sort of enforcement, public safety, right? Which is this exceptionally vague, because it's like, what laws do you have to break for that to happen? Whereas here you're putting something very proactive, where you could theoretically, right, it's a cooperative and communal exercise to create such an assessment, and then it's transparent, right? And it's actually working sort of towards something as opposed to being punitive. So, I mean, is something like that needs assessment itself part of that accessible aesthetic, or would you, or not?
One of the things I want to say about a needs assessment, and like there's a certain idea, there's a certain like democratic idea that like, oh, if you just talk to people, then you'll come into like what you actually want to do, and that will be radical and transformative. I've found that to be very, actually not the case. Like, I think that in general, if you talk to people, they will tell you what they think you want them to say. Often, like, they'll people, especially, and this is especially a case, like, in a highly segregated city like Carbondale, where there's this, like, serious, long-term, like racial, you know, racism in this town. Like, it's actually very hard to get to a place where, like, people have things that they'll say based on what they think you want them, based on what they think they're allowed to want, is essentially it, right? And so that's why it's very important to actually have, like, a program that puts forward things that gives people permission to want things that they don't think they're allowed to want yet.
But, like, expanding people's capacity to imagine, like, what they could even consider or call a need, right? It's like, now all of a sudden I get to need less police.
Yeah.
Like, I never thought that was possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can totally need less police in your life. Like, please imagine a world where that is, like, the case.
And that's actually like the central thing, right? Like, so I remember there's a group in Carbondale that was actually advocating for more police on the northeast side, which is like the largely black side of town. And I was talking to one of these people, and I was like, hey, like, why are you doing that? And it's like, there's like a whole range of standard arguments for like high crime, violence, therefore more police. But then when you like peel back the layer, and you're like, yeah, but like, let's remember back a few decades and how people were organizing for the community here. There was a Panther chapter here in Carbondale, and their house got shot up by the police, and that's when basically nothing that anybody could, like basically a situation was created in which people didn't feel like they could ask for anything else except more police. And so now that's the only political solution to any problem, it's just more cops. You know, and so you have to, or part of the aim here is to give people permission to actually want different things. Brian had a question there.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear a little bit about, you know, group process, because group process has often kind of created a tighter group where everyone shares, you know, it's the point where you start to have a kind of group identity. I'm fascinated also in terms of aesthetics at your little timers. The way you're letting the word circulate and demonstrating to all of us that you have a way of allowing people to take space without taking all the space. You're kind of also, just by who you are, demonstrating that sitting at this panel, there are different kinds of people, perhaps with different agenda elements, with different personal stakes in this thing. And that's quite different than many radical group processes that I've, you know, participated in or seen in action in the past, and I'm wondering if that is an element of this of the kind of permeability of your group that allows you to put forth radical things without scaring people off. Do I have to be like them in order to want this thing that I also want? You know?
No. That's a really interesting question.
Yeah. Very early on, right? Like we had an individual come into one of our group sessions, and they identified themselves and like with their past ideological identifications, right? It was like they were a Republican, but they saw like a like stuff that they could just agree with or like see as, again, common sense, right? Like we've got people from all over what would be like a traditional U.S. political dialogue who are looking at what we're proposing and seeing, like we're asking for a reduction in, it's an internal joke here where we like say same size government or something like that, and that's super funny for me. But like we're not asking for there to be a reduction in municipal funds or like lower taxes. We're just asking for a redistribution of those funds. But we're asking for like a reduction in one facet of like the municipal government spending, and like that notion of like smaller government, right? Or like that appeals to like this conservative mindset. But like we're not saying that. It's just what they're hearing when we say something. So like I do think that there's this sort of, as you put it, permeability, right? Like we're intentionally putting things out there that I don't want to build a world that is exclusionary. I don't want to build a world where like people who have been like duped or brainwashed or like bought into a system and the way in which politics is done in the United States, no matter what side you choose under the current dialogue, it all serves power. Like I don't want people who have bought into that system to feel excluded from like this process of relearning like who's your actual enemy.
Are accepted and fully explored. It's almost like passing the coup stick back and forth. Everybody gets a space to say what they think and how they feel. So it's unlike any other experience that I personally towards a common goal or an uncommon goal.
That's really nice to hear. And the thing then that grounds it, though, is that, like, yeah, there's no ideological litmus test for being involved, but it's just like, are you on board with doing these things? And you can be on board with doing these things for all sorts of reasons, right? Like, you hate wasteful government spending? Great, you know? Take a look at the police department, you know? You want to grow food because you don't want people to be dependent upon the federal government for food stamps? Great, let's grow food in town, you know? There's just all these different angles that you can come at it from. And I mean, I think, like, overall people like lean lefty, but not necessarily, and that's just in terms of, like, the folks that are organizing. But really, like, it's interesting to, like, because you can imagine it's sort of constructed first as, like, this coded way to be lefty or something. But then what's even more exciting is to actually just, like, leave the left behind and talk about the things that you're trying to do and just really try to, like, break out of the existing political apparatuses and focus on what you're, where you are.
I think that's an exciting commitment to make to each other, just like hearing all ideas. We often talk about whatever is coming next is it going to look like industrial Marxism or like anarchism, how it's been put forth up to now. It is going to look like something different. And as like dissenting views come in, we take that very seriously, and a lot of us made a commitment to dialectics, right? Finding a new synthesis to new ideas and new avenues of finding ways to put projects on ground.
So we're also, and I just discussed this with these people, these folks here, before we took this stage, is that, like, we started out with a lot of pliability, right? Like, we weren't trying to be so rigid that we'd break if someone came in with a new idea or, like, a fresh thing that they thought could be, like, a value or an addition to what we're doing. I would hate to see, and sometimes things necessitate, like the presupposition of a form, right? And then, like, as people are assigning a function to that form, the form is forced to break in order to, like, to meet the needs of that function. Like, I would really like to build into whatever we're creating here something where, like, people are relating to one another and each other's ideas and each other's, like minds, their observational capacities in an organic way, and that those forms just sort of spring up out of this process. Like, we're figuring out it out as we go. This is an experiment, but, like, it's really fun. Sure.
Was there another question?
Oh, yes.
So,
when you say rejoin
one's
conflict, what exactly does that mean?
So, in the sense that, like, the country's more divided than it's ever been in the United States, right? And I'll just use the United States as an example, even though we're technically organizing continent-wide, where you've got, like, a two-party system, a two-party dialogue, in which, like, half of the country is being pitted against half of the country. And, like, when you're looking at who's responsible for the illnesses and ailments of our world, it's, like, definitely not half of the country, right? Like it's people with a lot of money, people with a lot of power, right? Because of that money under capitalism, right? Like, if money can buy you a sort of power, like, that's what it's doing right now. And they're using it to destroy our planet, destroy our way of relating to one another, fracture our ability to, like, communicate even effectively or identify with one another, to see each other as more similar than we are different. And when I say, like, redrawing the lines of conflict, it's sort of, like, spurring this on-the-ground, bottom-up, grassroots unity, allowing that as much space to grow as possible. At least that's what it means to me.
I'll just add one more thing, because I think that's a super important point. Yeah, that, like, classically, one of the ways that the lines of conflict were drawn by people that recognize the point Claire's making is among, like, workers and capitalists, you know, like, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, and that, like, today, actually, like, those aren't really the best lines in terms of describing the kind of changes that we need, and that, in fact, it's more adequately, like, a struggle of, like, those of us that are like trying to build the conditions for life to continue, versus the people that, for some reason, don't care about that, and
or have some crackpot notion that they're going to make it to Mars and, like,
yeah,
colonize that.
And
with
it's
their,
all of us against
tech
the people that want to go to Mars. Basically.
Yeah.
So.
city government itself and the mayor's office and the staff have issued that it is as a result of their high numbers of calls for service, right? We've also analyzed an independent consultant report that looked over all of the police data, right? And they determined that what they consider calls for service is entirely unique and non-standard, and that like they're basically messing with their numbers.
I call that corruption. Not a lot of people are like willing to use that word.
What did you say?
I call that corruption.
Corruption.
And we've overtly accused the police department of manipulating their calls for service data in order to justify their numbers amidst a shrinking population. So part of the context here is that over the last 10 years, the population of the university has been cut in half. So that's 10,000 people less than were here just 10 years ago. And that's what really drives this to a point where it's so extraordinarily, so much higher. The actual like rise in the police numbers, the police department actually goes back to the early 1970s here, when in 1970 there was an 8-day insurrection in this town where the students went on strike and basically it was like the whole town against the National Guard. And then the police numbers shoot up quite a bit right after that. So not in response to crime, but in response to a political insurgency, there was then a huge rise in policing, and then many years, and it kind of steadily rose, and then the population dropped. So.
We gotta
make room.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Check their website for a very good answer to this question.